It's kind of a whole new experience having honks be a compliment rather than an insult to my driving abilities, and they'll have to get used to that as well. It is good to be here again on a beautiful sunny day. If you didn't open up that page on your phone, we're going to be in Daniel chapter 7, Matthew 26, and a couple of different spots in the book of Revelation this morning. Perhaps you have seen online those sometimes ridiculous and sometimes disturbing images where they try to show you what it would look like if two people had a baby. What they do is they take two different people and they morph their pictures into a single image. Now, sometimes it combines their best features to give you a very beautiful baby, but it's far more entertaining when it combines their worst features and you end up with something that looks like Baby Yoda. Now, we laugh at these silly creations, but there's also an element of truth in them because we all know that children take after their parents when it comes to certain things. So, you know, you might have one child that gets, you know, mom's eyes and dad's hair. Maybe they get mom's sense of humor and dad's, you know, quick-witted sarcasm. And we've all had those proud moments as parents where we look at something our child does and we say, yeah, that's my kid. You know, they take after their dad. They take after their mom. And we've also had those embarrassing moments where we look at our spouse and we say, hey, don't look at me. It's not my kid. That's your kid. Now, we don't know what Jesus looked like, but as we saw a couple of weeks ago in the book of Isaiah, apparently he was an average, ordinary guy. There was nothing extraordinary about his appearance. But the picture that we have of Jesus in the Bible shows us that there were many traits where Jesus took after his Father. When it comes to his holiness, his righteousness, his love, his mercy, Jesus was just like his Father. He was the Son of God. Now, just to be clear, when we talk about God the Father and Jesus the Son, we're not saying that God was physically Jesus' Father. That is simply a way of saying that he was of the same nature, of the same divine essence as God. But there's also another picture we get of Jesus in the Bible. There's somebody else that he has their traits. He bears a remarkable resemblance to you and to me. You see, Jesus shared in our humanity. Not only was he the Son of God, he was the Son of man. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14 says, because as God's children, are human beings made of flesh and blood, the Son also became flesh and blood. For only as a human being could he die, and only by dying could he break the power of the devil who had the power of death. And Hebrews goes on to say, it was necessary for him to be made in every respect like us. And it even says that Jesus is not ashamed to call us his brother or his sister. There is definitely a family resemblance. So in Jesus, we see both the Son of God and the Son of man. And I really want to zero in this morning on this idea of the Son of man. Now, Son of man is an expression that occurs throughout the Bible. It is used 107 times in the Old Testament. It is used 81 times in the four Gospels that tell the story of Jesus. And we find it four more times in the rest of the New Testament, most significantly in the book of Revelation. Now, at its most basic level, Son of Man was simply a title of address. It was an expression that's used for all sorts of different people in the Bible most frequently. It's in the Old Testament, it's used of Ezekiel. It's a way of saying, remember you're only human. You're just a person. Remember who you are. Remember where you came from. You're just a man. You're no different than anyone else. And so in its ordinary use, Son of Man was a way of distinguishing our physical, mortal existence from the immortal, spiritual essence of, say, God or the angels. But when we get to the book of Daniel, there is a prophecy that seems to invest this phrase, Son of Man, with much deeper meaning and infuses it with messianic expectations. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel is given these grand visions of the unfolding of human history and some of the major players that will cross the stage of the human drama. He sees four great beasts rise up out of the sea. First is a lion with the wings of eagles. The second is a bear with three ribs in its mouth. The third is a leopard with four heads and four wings of a bird on its back. And then comes a fourth, terrifying beast with 10 horns. And amongst the 10 horns comes a little horn. And this horn is covered with eyes and a mouth that speaks great things. Then the vision turns to what appears to be a heavenly courtroom scene. And there are thrones. And someone called the Ancient of Days comes and takes his seat upon the throne. Now, the Ancient of Days is a title that Daniel uses for God the Father. Ancient of Days is a way of referring to God's timeless and eternal nature. The very opening words of the Bible are, "In the beginning, God." The idea is that before there were any days, there was God. And so this becomes a title for God. Now, before these thrones and before the Ancient of Days, Daniel sees 10,000 times 10,000 standing before them. Now, we're not told immediately who or what these thousands and thousands are, but as you read through Daniel's vision and further on in the chapter, every indication is that these are saints of the Most High. These are the people of God. Now, as you might imagine, Daniel is overwhelmed by what he sees. He's baffled, he's confused, and so he goes to one of the many thousands that he sees and taps them on the shoulder and says, "Hey, buddy, what's going on?" Now, that's just my loose paraphrase from the Aramaic there. And so at the end of Daniel 7, the prophet is given an interpretation of the four beasts. He's told that they represent four earthly kingdoms, four powers that will rise, who will speak against the name of God, who will oppress his people. But in the end, the court of heaven, where the real authority, the real throne of power lies, shall judge and condemn these kingdoms, and all dominion and all glory and all power will be given to the saints. Now, there are other passages in Daniel, as well as history itself, that have led most Bible scholars to conclude that the four kingdoms of Daniel's vision are none other than the four great worldly empires that would dominate human history from the time of Daniel to the coming of Jesus. And they are as follows: the Babylonian Empire, who was ruling at the time of Daniel. When Daniel saw these visions, it was Babylon that was ruling. Following Babylon came the Medo-Persian Empire. And then came the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great. And then finally, the greatest and most terrifying of them all was the Roman Empire, who was, of course, ruling at the time of Jesus. Now, In my brief retelling of Daniel chapter 7, I have left out one major detail. You see, after Daniel sees the four beasts rise out of the sea, after he sees the heavenly courtroom, the throne scene, but before he's given the interpretation, there's one other element to the vision that Daniel sees. And we find it in verses 13 and 14 of Daniel 7. And our core verse this week, as we go through core 52, is here in verse 13. And here's what it says in these two verses. And behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given glory and dominion and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So Daniel doesn't just see a son of man, a person like any other person, just some random person, a human, but he sees one like a son of man. He appears to be a human, but he isn't merely human. And God gives this one like a son of man all dominion, all glory, and all power, so that he has a kingdom that includes all peoples and languages and nations. So it's a universal kingdom, and it's also an everlasting kingdom, an eternal kingdom that shall not end. And apparently, as you follow this all the way down through the end of the chapter, by the end, this one like a son of man who receives all of the dominion and glory and power will then in turn share that dominion, share that glory, share that power with all of the saints. And so Daniel, son of man, stands out as something new, something different. This is not the same expression of son of man that we've seen throughout the Bible to this point. This is not just a mere person. Now, press your fast forward button about 550 years. And this brings us to the first century, to the four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and to the ministry of Jesus. Throughout his earthly ministry, Jesus' favorite title for himself, far above every other thing that he called himself, was Son of Man. In fact, was it 78 times Jesus calls himself Son of Man in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? But Jesus does something a little different with the term. He doesn't just call himself a Son of Man. He puts the in front of it. So he is the Son of Man. Jesus isn't saying that he's just a person like any other person, but Jesus is referring to something specific, something identifiable. I am the Son of Man. And what Jesus is doing is he is referring back to Daniel chapter 7. And he is saying, I am the one that Daniel was talking about. I am the one like a son of man. I am the one that was to receive a universal and eternal kingdom. I am the one whose saints will reign with him in eternity. I am that son of man. That's what Jesus is saying. Now maybe somebody might argue, well, preacher, you're pushing it a little too far. You're reading too much into it. But Jesus leaves absolutely no doubt when we turn to Matthew chapter 26. Now the scene here is Jesus has been arrested, he's being tried, he's being questioned, and in one of the only responses that Jesus gives to either the religious or the civil authorities that arrested him, we read this in Matthew 26, verses 63 through 68. But Jesus remained silent, just like it says in Isaiah 53 that we looked at just a few weeks ago. And the high priest said to him, I adjure you, by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. All right, so that's like a judge saying, swear on the Bible. Make an oath. Verse 64. Jesus said to him, you have said so. But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Here Jesus is using the exact same language that Daniel 7 uses. And look at the priest's response. Then the high priest tore his robes and said, he has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment? They answered, he deserves death. Then they spit in his face and struck him, and some slapped him, saying, prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you? So Jesus here clearly references Daniel's prophecy, and he applies it to himself. And the religious leaders clearly recognize that Jesus is making a claim to be none other than the Christ, the Anointed One, the Messiah. But in doing so, he uses Daniel's title as the Son of Man, but they had questioned him about being the Son of God. Matthew 26, in a strange turn of events, puts the Son of Man on the same level with the Son of God. He is the Son of God. He is of the same essence, the same nature as God. He is just like his Father. But somehow, at the same time, Jesus is also the Son of Man. He fully identifies with us. He fully identifies with you. And when I say that, I'm not using the word identify in the modern sense where we have men today who identify as women or women who identify as men. When I say that Jesus identified as us, I'm not saying that he took a few hormones, had a little cosmetic surgery, and dressed up in human clothes. No, Jesus became fully flesh. He became fully human, and he lived as one of us. Philippians chapter 2 says, beginning in verse 5, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And so the Son of God humbles himself, empties himself of his divine power, his divine glory, his everything that comes with being the Son of God. He willingly sets that aside and he trades it in to take on skin, flesh, and bone. And he becomes Isaiah's suffering servant that we looked at a couple weeks ago. Now, if you grew up in the church and you've been a Christian for a long time, this is all old news to you. This sounds so natural to us. Yeah, God became flesh to live as one of us so that he could die for us and pay the price for our sins. But for Jews, for Muslims, for so many skeptics out there, this makes no sense at all. This is completely absurd. God can't become flesh. The Creator can't become the created. That's like putting 1,000,000 pounds of potatoes in a 5-pound sack. It makes no sense. It's impossible. But you see, this is why Christmas is such a miracle that brings good news of great joy. This is what is so astounding and genius about the incarnation, that you can somehow stuff the infinite into a finite package so that we can be with God and share with him. And someone might say, but that's impossible. But I would say, impossible is exactly what we need. Because you and I are stuck in impossible situation. Our sin put us in a situation where there is no escape, there is no out, unless you have a God who is capable of doing the impossible. And praise God, He is capable of doing the impossible. Now, as we continue to pull on this thread of the Son of Man in the Bible, we follow it all the way to the very last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. And here, in John's great vision of the culmination of the kingdom and his ultimate plan for his creation and his people, John has a vision of Jesus. And the Jesus that John sees is not the meek and mild baby born in a manger. It isn't Isaiah's suffering servant who walked in human feet on the dusty roads of Judea and Galilee. No, this is somebody quite different. What he sees is a risen and victorious Lord. He sees Jesus not as he was when he came the first time, but he sees Jesus as he will be when he comes the final time. In Revelation chapter 1, we get the very first glimpse of Jesus. We see what John sees. In verse 13, he is introduced to us as one like a son of man. Again, using the same language as Daniel chapter 7 and as Matthew 26. This is John's way, and it's the Holy Spirit's way in inspiring John to write this, of telling us, this is who Daniel was talking about. This is what Daniel saw in his vision. This is Daniel, son of man. But the son of man that John sees is no mere human being. He looks like a man, but this is no frail flesh and bones easily broken. John describes Jesus in the most superhuman terms available to his imagination. If John was writing this as one of us, he would be borrowing all the superhero motifs from the Marvel Universe and the DC Comics Universe to try to describe Jesus and emphasize his greatness, his power, and his authority. He would have Superman's laser vision, Captain America's shield, and Spider-Man's web-slinging wrists. But John describes Jesus by borrowing images from a first century fantasy world, something known as apocalyptic literature. Jesus is wearing a long robe with a gold sash, which display his royalty, his rank, and his beauty. His head and his hair, they shine white, a whiteness whiter than snow, which show his eternal wisdom and purity. His eyes are like flames of fire, which tell us that he sees everything with a piercing vision. His feet are like polished bronze refined in a furnace, which symbolize the purity of judgment with which he will trample his enemies underfoot. His voice thundered like mighty ocean waves, which shows that he speaks with the power to sweep away all that lie before him. And so that's John's first glimpse. As Revelation continues, we get to a scene in Revelation 4 and 5, and it's a scene that is remarkably similar to what Daniel sees in Daniel chapter 7. Again, it is a heavenly courtroom, a heavenly throne room. There are thrones, and again, God is seated upon the throne, and around the thrones are thousands times thousands times thousands. But John sees it with more detail. These myriads of people that surround the throne, they are living creatures, they are angels, and they are people from every tribe, every language, every nation, just like Daniel saw. And they surround the throne. And this time, just like in Daniel chapter 7, the Ancient of Days, the one who sits upon the throne, is joined by someone else. But this time, it's Jesus, the Son of Man. But in this vision, he's portrayed as a lamb who had been slain. And he has seven horns and seven eyes, which picture complete power and complete knowledge. And he receives worship from every living thing in heaven and on earth. And then as we go through Revelation, we get to Revelation chapter 14. And this is right before the earth is harvested in judgment. And in verse 14, John says this, "Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man." There is the Daniel 7 language once again. "With a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand." This comes right out of Daniel 7. It comes right out of Matthew 26. But this time, the one like a son of man is wearing a crown, which emphasizes his reign, his rule, his authority, his dominion. He's carrying a blade, a sickle, which speaks of his judgment. And he's about to harvest humanity. And humanity in this vision is pictured as a grape harvest. And he's going to harvest these grapes, and they're going to be placed into the winepress of God's wrath. The Son of Man in Revelation 14 has come to rule over his kingdom and conquer his enemies. And so now we have come full circle. Jesus started out as the Son of God who sat at the Father's right hand, but then Jesus humbles himself. He willingly lays aside his divinity. He takes on human flesh, trades in his dominion and glory and power to take on the very nature of a person. And God became one of us. The Son of God became a mere son of man. I don't share all of this with you this morning. It's just a bit of Bible trivia. This is not just some theological history we're talking about. I share all of this because I believe all of it has a very real impact on your life. And it's something that's told to Daniel in Daniel chapter 7. As his visions are being interpreted for Daniel, this is what he's told in verse 27. "And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him." So who is it that Jesus is going to give his kingdom and dominion and power to? It says here, "It shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High." Who's he talking about here? Who are these people? Who are these saints? He's talking about us. He's talking about believers. He's talking about those who follow Jesus. Jesus is going to share his glory and his dominion with us. We will rule with him in his kingdom. There's an amazing verse in Revelation chapter 3, verse 21. Jesus sends letters to each of the seven churches there in Revelation. And he makes this incredible promise to those who overcome. He says, "The one who conquers, I will grant him to sit with me on my throne, as I also conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne." So follow Jesus' train of thought here. The Son of God became one like a son of man so that we, the sons and daughters of men, could share with him, the Son of God. That's pretty cool. And this is just one more way the whole Bible is tied together. From Genesis to Daniel to Matthew to Revelation. It all is tied together and it makes perfect sense. Now, if God can bring all of that together, he can weave all of that planning together and tie all of those threads together, what do you think he can do with what appears to be the loose threads of your life? Don't you think he can tie those together too? We debate politics and power endlessly on earth. And just like those kingdoms of Daniel's vision, the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, kingdoms rise and kingdoms fall. We see administrations come and go. We see the power parties in power ebb and flow. But what you need to know this morning is that the real throne of power isn't in Jefferson City. The real throne of power isn't in Washington, D.C. It isn't in Beijing. The real power isn't with you or any other person. The real power isn't with some stupid virus or stay-at-home orders. Ultimate dominion and final authority come from the throne of heaven. We've had a lot of uncertainty these last few weeks. Some of us have really wrestled with uncertainty about our jobs, uncertainty about finances, uncertainty about the future, maybe even some uncertainty about our health, about life itself. But the real throne of power, who's in control of everything, who can tie this all together, who can make sense of it all, who can make it work out for ultimately the best purpose, is the throne of heaven. And everyone will answer to the one who sits on the throne. And the one who sits on the throne is none other than the Son of God, who became the Son of Man, the one who walked in your shoes, who lived in your skin, who faced everything that you have faced, and he died for everything that has broken you and everything that you have broken. And he did all of that so that one day you can sit on the throne with him. That's amazing. And that's what gives us hope. And that's what gives us purpose.